idea. They were, Jerry was talking to who is in charge here, program, that he had a couple holes in the schedule, and I said, well, one thing I thought of doing periodically and would like to try is a discussion about what people's questions around when they know someone who's dying or if they've had someone who dies, what it feels like, what's happened. And where that comes from is, included in my background was 3 years working as an oncology nurse. And there was numerous times when family members would come up to me or a lot of times it's the silence and you learn to read the silence. And look at me and I would look at them and say, do you know what to expect? Well, no, I've never been around somebody who's dying. What's the process like? Well, here's what we expect will happen, and here's what I'm looking for. Or they would have a family member who was near death, or even sometimes weeks from it and quite lucid, but obviously dying, and not know what to say and feel very tongue-tied by it. The other side of the coin is from the patient's perspective of, I wish people would say this instead of coming in here and doing such and such. So that's kind of what planted the seed of the idea of having this as a presentation. The other pieces to my background that I'll include in it is I have some emergency room experience where you have the tragedy of a sudden unexpected death. I have, I currently work on an infrequent basis, but several times a month at an AIDS facility and deal with terminal AIDS patients. And also my background includes perinatal care. Perinatal, I'm speaking nurse here. Whenever we want to start speaking nurse, stop us and ask us to be fine. Perinatal is pregnancy through several months after the baby is born. And along with that comes the tragedy, often just the tragedy of an unexpected C-section, but the tragedy of a miscarriage during the pregnancy or a baby that dies soon after birth. So that's kind of my background. I'll turn it to Helsa at this point, who is the official village nurse.
I've been here for 2 years, and I've been the village nurse as well as a number of other things here at Holden. And my background prior to that, well, I've worked with people who were dying and their families in several different capacities as a nurse. And I've also had close family members who passed on and dealt with personal feelings. So many of us have had that experience, but sometimes that helps you then to understand what others go through. I'm on this panel specifically because of my experiences choosing to care for those who are going through labor, who knew that their baby would be dead or dying at birth. And I also chose to be here because I believe in our modern Western culture, we no longer know how to deal with death well, and would often rather not talk about it than to face our weakness. That's kind of my background.
And our other panelist is Martha, who is the part-time nurse here for a couple of few weeks.
I'm kind of doing a touch and go here at Holden. I'm here for 3 weeks. But my experience before coming here is in the emergency department, where you have a lot of different types of deaths to confront with people, and most of them you don't know very well at the time. And also with people going through different types of tests, waiting for a diagnosis in several different capacities of getting radiological tests and also endoscopies. For those of you who had those sorts of tests, that's nurse talk again. Let's see here.
Putting a tube down into your stomach to look around.
Or the other way. Or the other way. And so their biopsies taken, ultimately you get, you're either relieved or you're not. And there's a lot of uneasiness that goes along with that. I also feel like because I'm a nurse, I had the opportunity to be with a lot of my friends through a lot of different things and able to talk with them on a different level maybe because of that. And actually I think some of those experiences are probably my most valuable, I think. And maybe some of you have had, you know, likewise the same opportunities. I also agree, as Halsa does, that in our Western culture, we don't deal well with just aging, period, let alone that final state of our earthly life. Now, it took me a couple years to admit that I needed these crazy reading glasses so that I could see things up close. So, you know, that's
which
just
she's
a smart.
Not wearing those.
but I don't leave home without them anymore. They're here. So, you know, I didn't deal well with that. And that's a pretty small item of aging, really, in the whole scope of things. And I know that in other cultures still, like in Eastern Europe, I know that they deal with it a whole lot differently. And it's really a more of a celebration sometimes rather than, you know, all awful and grim and a mystery.
Okay. One of the agreements that we had here was they jumped at the opportunity, but they said that I had to be the moderator. if you didn't hear it this morning, kind of our introductory statement, I didn't say what my current job. My current job is I'm a professor of nursing at Shoreline Community College. And this is an example that I found in Tony Hillerman writes about the Navajo Reservation all the time. And they're fiction books, but I love this story he told once of an old Navajo woman who was returning from the hospital where the Western medicine doctors had cared for her. She came back into the reservation with a diagnosis of terminal cancer. She went through a native healing ceremony and was healed, but she died the next day. And to us, in our culture, often the idea of healing means that you get better. It doesn't mean that you die the next day. And I use that example to talk to my students about the difference in my mind between healing with a patient and curing a patient. There are many, many times when we cannot cure a patient, but we can help them heal. I think the way I'm going to approach this is to give some examples of things that have happened, things I've seen along the way, and then to suggest some topics of way, directions that you guys might want to go, and then we'll take your comments and questions and go from there. One of the things that, let me get down from where my notes are here.
Tell
my glasses. I need them. The underlying concept, I guess, of this whole talk, if I were to sum up everything we're going to say tonight in one statement, would be let the person who's dying tell you what, ask, talk to you and tell you what to say. That be a child or an adult, it doesn't matter. When you talk to someone who's dying, don't put your values into them. What I mean by that is, as an example of, and I hear this over and over working with patients who are dying, a family member comes in and says, "Oh, how are you doing today? I certainly hope you're doing better. You're such a fighter." Now, have they given that patient the chance, I should get away from the word patient in this case, their friend, their family member, a chance to say, "I'm feeling like crap, I'm dying, I've got issues I want to take care of." And really they haven't. Many, many times I've sat outside at the nurse's station, grabbed family members and said, "Hey, we need to talk. You've got a family member in there who's dying. They're really dying. wishing that they won't die isn't going to change that. That person in there is waiting for your permission to die. They have things they need to talk to you about, but you've got to give them time. And often the family members tell me, well, that's really hard. I don't want to lose them. Then we have to talk through. The reality is, yes, you are going to lose them. It is going to leave a big black hole in your life. There's no way about it. That's going to change. It's going to hurt a heck of a lot when that happens. But that pain will eventually go away. Often, you wouldn't believe how many times, as nurses, you get kind of this your scripts. And one of my scripts is to go into a patient's room and say, how are you doing today? And invariably, they come back with the culturally appropriate answer, I'm fine. And I turn to them and say, no, I really want to know how you're doing. And they will look at me and say, well, I don't feel real good today, and things seem to be getting worse. And I'll say, well, what do you expect to be the outcome of this disease? And often they'll say, I think I'm going to die from it. Now, I've learned over time that when you do that, you make sure you have lots and lots of time to sit and listen. Because at that point, you've opened the can of worms up, and the patient may have lots of things they need to say.
Are we holding questions?
We will at the end.
Good.
I'm going to get through the introduction.
Good idea.
One case that always comes really close to mind was I went in and I hadn't seen anybody visiting this one guy. And I went in and we had kind of the same talk. And I said, well, how do you feel about he said, I think I'm going to die. And I said, probably that's true. And I said, how do you feel about that? And he said, well, I'm kind of concerned. I said, yeah. And he said, I don't know if I'm going to go to heaven or not. These stories get really hard for me. So I sat with him and I said, well, what do you do for a living? And he says, well, I drive truck, long-haul truck. I said, well, what do you mean? And he says, well, I don't think I've done good in my life. And I says, well, what did you do for a living? And he says, I drive long-haul truck. And I said, well, did you ever, you mean you never stopped to pick up a hitchhiker along the way? Well, yeah, I did that lots of times. And he said, and I said, well, you mean you never helped somebody that had a flat tire? Well, yeah, I did that lots of times. And I looked at him and I said, I think you'll go to heaven. And there was healing. He died, in fact, a couple days later. I'm going to tell you some other thoughts of things you might want to bring up, and then Jerry has the first question hot on his tip of his tongue.
At some point, I'd like to throw in just...
Yeah. Some other comments. I think it's important for us to feel comfortable giving people permission to die. I don't know. One of the things you will hear nurses who work with people who are dying frequently say is they're waiting for their family to say it's okay. And they're just hanging on through the pain, through the discomfort, waiting for that permission. I'm not a pediatrics nurse, but one of the universals I hear from pediatrics nurses who work with dying children is talk to them about their dying. There are so many who will come up with stories about the child going to the nurse and saying, I'm dying, but don't tell my parents because they don't know yet. And the parents saying, well, don't tell my child that they're dying. Children know. They need to be talked about it. What to do? Touch the person, hold them, climb in bed with them. The other comment is you'll hear nurses talking about a good death and a bad death. A bad death to me is the patient who dies alone in pain. And my job is to keep that from happening. And I think that was one of the things I was going to talk or open the topic to, is I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about what can be done for pain control. And if you want to as we get towards the end, talk about pain control, we can have a long talk about it, because what people say is not the truth. The truth is we can control pain. Okay? Elsa?
I don't necessarily need to talk now, but there are many of you who at some point are going to have dealings with somebody who knows that they're losing a baby, or who does lose a baby unexpectedly. And there are some things that have changed a lot over the years in the way we handle that, and that may be something people will want to know about. So.
Yes.
But I think let's entertain questions and then I can...
Okay, Jerry, you're on.
Hope it's good.
Two questions. One is, what do you do when the dying patient doesn't want to talk? And there's a desire, you know, I mean, the family knows the person is dying. And the other question deals with, when do you bring in your pastor, or how have you dealt with that situation?
That's a big question. Let me play with it from two angles. One is, I used to not be able to talk about my spiritual self. When I started working with on the cancer floor, I had to learn to, because of walking into the truck driver's room to clean up the room and finding out that there were things he needed dealt with. I wrote a paper once when I was in graduate school about two types of patients that I saw a difference in. Those who were comfortable with themselves spiritually and those who weren't. And it had nothing to do with going to church, curiously enough. Some people were very churched, but didn't feel the fullness to their life, the readiness that things were under control. And as they were dying, they felt out of control. That patient may well be your silent patient. When to bring the pastor in, I think, when I worked there, I was in a Catholic hospital. One of the things I learned to love there was that we had 24-hour chaplain coverage, and the chaplain visited everybody, whether they wanted them or not. And, no, I mean, in a sense of, oh, I'm your chaplain. If you need me, I'm here. And I think that's the answer, is to say, if you need me, I'm here, and, you know, on a routine basis, keep saying that. And the patients who aren't spiritually comfortable in their world or with themselves are the ones who are really hard to work with, because they will fight death when it's coming. We have this concept in our society of fighting death as being a good thing, that you fight it and you're a weak, you're a loser, you're on and on if you recognize that death is coming and let it come. And there is, help me out here, guys, there's a fighting that is appropriate when you're going towards a cure. There's a fighting if you want to. I have a very close coworker whose husband went through tremendous amounts of chemotherapy with tremendous side effects, extended his life by a year. Their goal was to see every coffee shop in one, have a latte in each state. They almost made it. But as funny as that sounds, that year was tremendously valuable to that couple. That kind of fighting is appropriate. The fighting of fighting against something that's inevitable, I think sometimes I'm not sure about.
We look at it as a win-lose situation. If you get better, you win. And if you die, you lose. And you don't lose. You know, maybe you're not here to enrich the lives, you know, with your physical presence, but to die, with respect, or, you know, and to go on to the, you know, a better life. I mean, I don't think it's going to be so awful for me. Awful for the people I leave behind, but not, you know, for me, myself.
But not always true there either, right? I mean, I know this always sounds so odd to say it, but being a part of the deaths of my mother, my father-in-law, and my mother-in-law were some of the most life-affirming things that I've ever experienced. And I think sometimes our problem with knowing what to say to the patient is our concerns for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And this, at any time, is a time to set that aside and to try before you walk into that room, to be walking into them.
Mm-hmm.
And to walk into that room, I heard so many people say, I'm not going to the hospital to see them because I want to remember them the way they were. And I find that to be a very, very sad thing.
I do too. I guess that to go away from here, I would like you all to go away thinking that you can't leave that person alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if you go in and that person doesn't want to talk to you, you can show your compassion by going in and just sitting with that person. I mean, to die and have them not know that you care about them is much worse. And I think it's also more difficult for you, mm-hmm. ultimately, because then, you know, you got all that guilt stuff that you got to deal with, and that's not good either.
Which brings us back to Jerry's other question. What do you say to the person who doesn't want to talk? There is an art to listening, and part of that art is accepting that silence is okay. Sitting at the bedside may be absolutely appropriate.
Uncomfortable.
The most that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And often maybe they can't, maybe you're not the right person to talk with them, but maybe they're able to talk with somebody else. I think lots of people that I've cared for probably talk to me more freely about it than their own families, but it gives them a chance to practice talking about it. I mean, you kind of have to practice it because you never do it. You know, unless you're going to start doing it today, you know.
Prepare like a crib sheet or something, a deathbed crib sheet.
No, it's hard to mix a lot of compassion with a crib sheet, I guess. I think you just have to.
When my mother died, she was comatose for
8 days.
And we was amazed how she hung on. But we sat with her and we talked with her, and in that kind of a situation, are they responsive to voice? I whispered to her and I said, you know, you need to let it go. And we gave her permission to die.
We believe that they are, but we don't know. One of the things you get when you work around dying patients is a lot of anecdotal stories that don't quite fit the rest of the world. The one that comes to mind is one of my AIDS patients. Sister came out immediately after he died and said, just before he died, I looked up and watched him wave.
I think that's where the science part of things and the faith part of things are really kind of at odds with one another. I personally would encourage everybody to go to the bedside and talk to your loved one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I honestly don't know whether they can hear you or not. I'm not sure anybody really knows. But I think if they can, you sure don't want them to miss what you have to say to them. And you need to say it to them, whether they hear it or not.
Well, sometimes it's for self-satisfaction.
Yes. There's so much to be gained.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of things you didn't say to that person, maybe.
And there are degrees, you know, of being comatose and conscious versus unconscious. And we don't always know exactly what state somebody is in at that moment. But there is evidence that there are times when people can hear. The hearing, you know, is one of those senses that goes last. Say that, although I think touch too, sometimes being able to respond to touch as well as sound.
Yeah, we often see patients that what we will know is that a quiet voice or a touch will settle a patient who is anxious in bed and tense.
I wanted to underline that when you were talking too about in types of talking, that the touch is a real communication that we forget about a lot of times. And the other thing that strikes me is so many times people forget that it's the first time this patient has died too, even if it's the first time you've been with someone died. I mean, that sounds dumb, but people go,
right.
She isn't a touchy person, she doesn't like to be touched. I'm sorry, this is somebody that's never experienced this before. Don't prejudge them by what you've experienced in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot more acceptance to that. Even if it is just holding their hand or putting a hand on their shoulder or brushing their hair.
One of the common conversations I've had with people who are dying, who have accepted that they're dying, is the fear of that final step. We may believe what's on the other side, but none of us has ever made that step and come back to talk about it and tell us what it's like. And there is real fear of that. And I find that people find it very helpful to let them speak of that fear and to say, yeah, I would be afraid too. Just so that they aren't feeling like they're the only one in the world feeling it.
Becky, you had a...
Oh, I just wanted to add, there is a book called Coma, not by Robin Cook, but another book, that he's actually, Arnie Mindell, who's a protege of Carl Jung, has been doing work with people in coma, and they are responsive. And there's evidence to suggest that they're actually doing some very deep inner work while they're in coma, that it is purposeful, you know, it's not just some medical condition. And I just wanted to add an aside about being alone, just in case there's somebody in here who has some feelings about not being with somebody when they died and they felt like they should have been. There are also situations, I'm also an RN and I also work in hospice. So there are also situations where people have been sitting with their dying one 24 hours a day for days. And the one moment that they've left the room is when they've been able to. So there are situations where, for whatever reason, they're either so connected or sometimes some people do need to be alone. So it can go both ways.
There's a real interesting phenomenon, too, that I've run into fairly frequently of family members feeling guilty. Let's say you've been called from the East Coast to Seattle for a person who's, the nurse calls you up and says, your family member is imminently dying, catch the next plane, get out here. And darn it, they don't die on as we plan. We don't quite understand that process that well. And you've got a business and a home life and your children and all this on the East Coast. And I've kind of learned to read people when it's happening. I'll turn to them and say, are you feeling guilty that you're kind of wishing they would be done with their dying? And it's something just to know that guilt is, you know, people feel that way, that they have a life to get on with. And especially, I'm sure you see it with hospice, with family members that have cared for somebody for months on end, and they feel guilty for having to get for this feeling. And sometimes it's real helpful to turn to the family members and say, what you're feeling is pretty normal. You have a life to live.
You can be downright angry that this person is not done as expected.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon. And people need to know that what they're feeling is perfectly normal, a normal emotion, and understood on top of everything else. Yeah.
Do you have any insight on how to handle children who are right in a situation where someone's dying?
I have a thought on that. I went to a seminar once in Minneapolis, and they invited the chaplain from one of the larger hospitals in the area to come and speak, and she was from East Germany. And her part was to talk about the death deal, and she said she's appalled at the way we handle death in this country. We, for the most part, take everybody to the hospital so that they can die in the hospital. There's hospice situations that doesn't happen. But in her country, and I believe even today, when somebody dies, they for the most part are dying at home. and their family is around them. And after they die, they are in a casket or box in their living room. And the children are there through the whole thing and playing around. She remembers as a child playing around the casket of an aunt of hers who died before she was buried. And it wasn't difficult for her at all. The difficult part comes for a child when you don't talk about it, you know? And we're not talking about it because we're uncomfortable with it.
I was a child when a very close family member of mine died, and she was dying of cancer, and my dad's a minister and my mom's a nurse, and they sat us down as kids and they told us what she would look like when we went to see her, and why she would have the marks on her face, and why she would be skinny, and the whole thing, and what cancer was. And so when we went in, we knew. And to be told something like that as a kid, it made it a lot easier, even though it was a really scary thing at the time. It was just a lot easier. And we went in there, and they said goodbye. And
you did it with the two people, the two most important people in your life at that time, were your parents, and they were both there with you.
And especially, they told me, it's okay to touch her, it's okay to hug her, it's okay to hold her hand, and that's what we did. You know, and that, for me as a kid, just to say goodbye, I don't even remember saying anything, I just remember hugging her, and she said, you're my best buddy. And that's what I remember, and when she died, that's the memory I have. And even though I can picture her as cancer and being skinny, as a child, I'm not afraid of that anymore. That was the disease, but it was okay to touch and hold.
Exactly.
And that made the
world. With my AIDS patients, so many of them being touched and held is so important because they feel like they've been pariahs of society for so long. They don't feel touchable. They're emaciated. They don't feel like anybody would want them anymore. It becomes terribly important. Yeah.
I'm just curious if the medical community as a whole is any more accepting of the out-of-body experience that people appear to have. My father-in-law had this, and I'm just curious. We were told by the nurses that it was the drugs and blah blah blah. And I'm just curious how that's looked upon.
I think there's probably as many different views of that as there are physicians and
probably
nurses practicing medicine. And I think mine has really changed dramatically in the last several years to believe more in the miracle. A pastor once gave a whole sermon on start seeing the miracles. And once I started thinking about that, they were there. I mean, they were incredible. We had a own personal experience from Minneapolis again. Nice old couple lived across the street. You know, the woman has demented, and she's still driving around town. And her husband, if he wasn't there, they wouldn't be able to stay in the house. And he's legally blind, but they're a nice couple. We just kind of keep an eye out at the house. Well, one day, the ambulance comes pulling up the street. And here comes the wife, Laura, poor Laura, down the driveway, just looking lost. And I knew she would be very confused, so I went over. Well, her husband had a stroke, and he was lying on a heap on the floor. And she called 911. I spoke with her daughter later on. Her daughter told me, we worked with her for months to get her to know how to dial 911, and she couldn't do it. She did it that day. Mm-hmm. It just...
It's so funny in my own life that on one hand, I grew up in the good scientific method, and you needed data, and you needed evidence, and so forth. And yet, it's really hard for me to look at the evidence I have. I remember a CCU, a coronary care unit patient, who kept having a major artery bleed, which is not a healthy thing to do. And when she came in sometime later and said, my grandfather was in the room the whole time. And I have to believe her. I have enough experiences like that, and yet it's really hard for me to, you know, it doesn't fit. So, what can you say?
With regards to whether I should tell a child, my adopted son was 3 when his birth mother died of cancer, and the people that he was with were not coping themselves, so they never discussed anything with it. They had the funeral, didn't even include him, didn't tell him his mother was there. It took him over 9 years to get to the point where he could deal with the thought that his mother was there.
Yeah, I don't think keeping something like that from a child is healthy at all for the child.
For me, I was extremely close to my great-grandmother for the whole time I was growing up. I mean, I spent a lot of time living with her, and we were best buddies. And she died when I was 7, and we expected that she might be going, but I didn't really understand it. You know, you're at that age, 6 to 7, where you're starting to begin to be more spiritual, but really understanding what death is. Even though we buried birds and that kind of thing, there's just not that realization. And I wasn't able to be with her right before she died, but my parents took me to the funeral home. And seeing her in the casket there and being able to touch her, I got to say goodbye. But I also, it was this first realization in my life of what death was, that I was not going to see her again. You know, that I love this woman, but that she would not be part of my life as a, a living being. And I could let go because I could be there with her. And I think it would have been very difficult for me if I hadn't had that contact with her, you know, at death.
Pretty final.
Yeah. But I think if I had been excluded from the whole thing, it would have taken me a lot longer to come to terms with not being able to see her again. But seeing her there, you know, I knew she was gone from this world. And it was very powerful. My son at the same age had a grandfather die that he hadn't been as close to. And for him, we gave him the option of looking in the casket. The casket was there, but it was, you know, high enough up that he would have needed a little boost to look in. And he played in the area. I mean, he was close to it, but he chose not to. But I think he knew, too, being with the family was enough to allow him to say goodbye without actually having to look at the body. So, you know, you kind of give the child options, but for me it was very powerful to see my grandmother, and I wanted to. You know, it wasn't like I was forced to do it.
I think over the course of a long illness, the family members who are closest, in closest proximity with the person who's ill and are involved in the day-to-day comings and goings of this person deal much more effectively with the actual death and all the stages along the way. Several people that I've known had parents, you know, that were needing more help, more assistance, and you know, they lived right there in the city where their parents did, and so, you know, they knew what was going on, but there were these other siblings that lived, you know, in Washington or way far away, and they weren't along on the trip. They didn't see the stages. And so when the siblings who are there want to be able to, you know, do what's best for their parents or what their parents want, this person who's out here doesn't want to deal with it. They have their own denial that they still haven't worked through to know that mom and dad just aren't the same anymore. And it's very difficult for those people who are physically removed from the person who's experiencing the decline in their health.
Saw that a lot with cancer patients. We would get the whole family online with the care plan and the treatment and what was going on, and then you'd have somebody come out from outside and have to go through the whole process again. Let's have one more question, then I want to switch to HELSA for a minute, and I want to jump on first. Yeah.
Way half an hour ago, I guess, there was a point of, yes, I've heard of in critical care, the idea, and terminal care, the idea is not to stave off death as long as possible. For my one family member, she died prematurely young. She was only 92. I figured in our family with longevity, she had at least 20 more years to go. Mm-hmm. And she had essentially, she was a devout Christian. She went to church in the neighborhood. And she knew that her body had failed. With heroic measures, with a nurse in her home 24 hours a day, and tubes and oxygen and everything, I suppose, she could have been kept alive a few more months. But
are you talking about dying gracefully, or with respect?
But she was ready to go. And she accepted medical care from the nursing home. Basically long enough to let her daughters get there and say goodbye.
One of the things that sometimes happens in intensive care units is we'll talk about that basically to us the patient has died, but that we're treating the family. And we will sometimes keep a body alive to let the family come and have their moment and acceptance.
Yeah, it was for us, for me in particular. I wanted her to be back in the spring attending her roadies. But, so I was fertilizing them every day. But she was able to face death and knew when it was time to go and was not afraid. And she taught me. Me out of the doctor.
Wonderful gift.
I'm going to switch to HELSA. I want to talk a little bit about death during pregnancy and after. And I'm going to tag on a little bit from the father's perspective.
Well, my role as a labor and delivery nurse, my job in general entailed providing for a safe delivery and comfort of the mother, as well as a meaningful birth experience. Since most of my coworkers, however, were not comfortable caring for patients who were anticipating what we call perinatal loss. They've come in because they have a baby who has died inside them, or they have a baby that they know is not going to survive beyond birth. I made this my specialty. And these were, without a doubt, my most satisfying experiences as a labor nurse. In years past, what we did was to heavily sedate the mothers, particularly with amnesic drugs, so they wouldn't remember the experience. The fetus, as we called it, was whisked away, so mother wouldn't see it. Of course, there was nobody allowed in the delivery room. And after quick look over by the staff, the baby was stuck in the fetus was stuck in a plastic bag and sent to the morgue.
And of course we told the mother, you're young enough, you can have more children.
Right, you can have more children. What we learned over time, and I mean this applies to adults as well as babies, but true healing, you know, the really deep healing, can't begin until you have a chance to say goodbye. And you can't say goodbye until you've said hello. And so the way most, I won't say all, because there are still places in this country where the medical staff and nursing staff aren't comfortable with this, but what we've learned is that go through the birth process unmedicated, if possible. I mean, if somebody really wants like an epidural anesthesia to control pain, that's fine, but to not sedate them in a way that they won't remember the experience. And then after the baby is born, to allow them a chance to really get to know this baby, but they'll never have a chance to know any other way. So to hold it, to name it is so important. When there's hair, we take hair clippings, we do fingerprints, weights and measures, just everything like you would on a normal baby who's born alive. And give them that chance to say goodbye, to hold the baby as long as they want. And most families, I mean, don't want to hold a baby for days. I guess you'd have to draw the limits, but that doesn't happen. But it gives them a chance, and they need to be together just the way they would be for a live birth. They need to have family there. A lot of what I did was to be with that person very deeply. There are people who don't want to talk, like, you know, Jenna's. But the idea was to allow them to speak. And what so often would come up were people's, they would start with the history of what had happened and how they found out and just the factual stuff, but then move into their feelings and the plans and the dreams they had that, you know, no longer were going to be. And for me, part of it was being able to cry with them. That's okay, you know, that people would feel comfortable in their own tears if they saw that I was comfortable in mine. And I would hold them and hold their baby and show them, you know, where you could. Look at this feature. I think this comes from you. Or, no, this one I think comes from your husband. Just letting them know how much this baby was a part of them, even though in reality, I mean, in the physical sense, the baby will not be part of their lives in the future. But it will always be part of the memory. And the pain diminishes, but it never goes away. You remember the birthday of that baby just like you would the birthday of a child who, you know, is born alive. One of the things that I saw too is that people, the unfortunate thing is our society's ability to deal with this. Women are expected to go immediately back to work. Well, you've had the baby and you don't have a baby at home and you're not having to do midnight feeding, so you should be able to go back to work. Several things have happened though. The body knows that you've been pregnant and have gone through delivery. And that takes a 6-week healing process. The other thing though is the emotional side of it and the fact that life is never going to be the same. You aren't going to be going back to life as it was before, as though you had never been pregnant. That baby will always be a part of your life. And that's where those of you who know somebody who loses a baby can help. I think sometimes going back to work after a short period of time to get things together can be helpful if you've got a job you love a supportive work environment where people allow you to mourn and be in that. But what happens is that most people are expected to get on with life. Well, you know, the baby's gone and it's time to snap out of it. And that's not going to happen for most people. For most people, there's a long period of mourning that they need support. They need to be allowed to talk. They need to be allowed to grieve. They need to have people recognize that birthday. There's an organization a close friend of mine started in Seattle. It's called Parents, well, it was called Parents of Stillborns, and now it's Parents of Stillborns and Neonatal Losses, but it's for people who've lost children. And they recognize the birthdays. There's, every month, there's a list of those babies who died a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And they recommend sending cards every year on that birthday to remind the family that you too remember the loss they went through, because they certainly are going to forget it. So for us to be aware of that and not try to sweep it under the table, I think with losing a parent or something, we're more likely to be open to the fact that this is a big loss, but and that people are, it's going to take a while to adjust, but the birth of a dead baby or a baby who dies, sometimes it's not immediately after birth, but any time in that perinatal period, people need support from all of us.
Yeah.
How about cases of abortion?
That's a tough one, because there are people who do not really want to have an abortion, but feel that it's something that it's necessary to do. And they can still suffer a lot of loss and look at those birthdays. But it depends on, you know, I think you have to go from the cues from that person. I mean, I would acknowledge it if somebody just saw it as a means of birth control. But it's, there are different kinds of situations, and you really have to know the person and find out what they want and how they
what the circumstances are.
Right, what the circumstances.
And often the other piece to that is even working in the delivery room, we would often find out as part of history taking that the person had had an elective abortion. And what we also found out was that this was not to be shared with their current husband. Mm-hmm. This may be a secret that's very, very much a secret. So that's a very, there's such a range of experiences associated there. I'm going to make two quick comments, and we have to clear the room in 5 minutes. So. One is, my own research was on fathers and pregnancy when I was going to graduate school. And one of the things that is very clear from what we've learned about women in pregnancy is that the baby is very real very early in the pregnancy for women. The comment about, we used to literally say this to mothers who had a miscarriage was, well, at least you're young enough to have another one. It was the most hurtful thing we could have ever said, and yet that was our way as medical professionals of feeling like we had said something. And covering our own feelings. What does turn out to be probably true, as much research has been done on it with fathers, is that in fact the pregnancy is not very real to them, to us, until after delivery. And what that means is a very different experience for men during pregnancy than for women. And the best example I can give is a close friend of mine came up to me one day and she said, I just lost my pregnancy. My husband is a merchant marine. He's in the middle of the South China Sea right now, something like that. Or he's just off the Japan, something like that. Anyway, I'll have 2 minutes of ship-to-shore telephone to tell him. What should I expect and what should I say? And I said, well, just the first thing you need to know is he's going to ask if you're okay. He's not going to be worried about the baby. And she looked at me and I said, to him, the baby isn't real. To him, you are very real because you're his spouse. You are the important thing in his life. And didn't think much more about it until she came up to me a couple days later and said, thank you for giving me that, because I would have felt so terrible, because I wouldn't have understood why he wasn't worried about the baby. He was worried about the baby. He was much more real worried about the person that was real to him. And I've got 3 minutes to give you a little bit of 2 bits on pain control, if that is interesting to you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, first off, cancer pain is absolutely controllable. Anyone who works with cancer, who works with pain control, can guarantee you cancer pain is controllable. If you are not having cancer pain controlled, Ms. Hospice Nurse, jump in any point you want, then you probably have somebody who doesn't know how to do pain control. And you need to either change physicians or go to a different facility where the nurses are used to pain control, get somebody, I mean that you can have 2 levels of that. You can have physicians who will not order adequate pain medication, and you can have nurses who will not give it. So there's 2 levels there.
3. You have people who give too much.
Pardon?
There's 3 levels. You have people who give too much for the family's peace of mind, not for the patient's always.
Oh. There's also the family members who, the patient who won't take it because of fear of addiction, and family members' fear of addiction. And addiction, over and over research has shown, addiction does not happen in severe terminal pain. It simply is unknown.
And it's not an issue.
It's not an issue. There's a thing called tolerance, which is entirely different. Tolerance we deal with by giving more medication. That's a physical thing. And the difference is that with tolerance, if the person's pain is cured, let's say we take a huge tumor off their spine and their pain goes away, within 2 or 3 days I can have their pain medication down to a very low level again to where their current pain is. That's tolerance. But addiction is, the best way, description ever given to me was a person would go and steal the medication. And when I explained it that way to my patients, then they would accept what they needed to take. In AIDS care, I can't give that same guarantee, quite frankly. I have never had a patient that I couldn't get control their pain in AIDS, but I have had coworkers who have. The dosing I have seen with AIDS patients, first off, a lot of the population I worked with or previously had used street drugs. And if you use one type of opioid, you also, or alcohol either, you increase your tolerance, that medical, physical condition, and it takes more medication to control their pain. The doses I have seen given to my AIDS patients, I've had one patient on 300 milligrams an hour of Dilaudid. I assure you, if anybody in this room got 300 milligrams an hour of Dilaudid, you would be dead within the next hour. And yet that person was one thing. I'll give an example of pain control in a surgical patient who needed it well, and it is a classically good example. I had a patient once who was, her breathing was poor, her color was awful, her blood pressure was awful. Everything in the nursing text at that point say she's over-medicated and to back off. I looked at it and said, this woman's in too much pain, gave her enough pain medication. Her breathing improved, she became more alert and was able to talk to me, and her blood pressure and things normalized. We often see this in terminal care. If we give adequate pain medication, we increase the alertness of the patient. They do much better when they're well controlled.
That's going to be my question.
Yeah.
If they've got issues to resolve, do the levels of medication increase?
Pain dose, you will see some sedation. But as they develop a tolerance within 24 hours, you'll usually see an increase in alertness. I see the staff waiting outside the door. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.